I think that the comparison which I made here is related to the danger of transgressing boundaries from the side of the analyst. It's not totally the same, but it's because the emotions and the danger of being too much involved as an analyst, if you don't pay attention to what is happening in ourselves with our own emotions, then it can be similar. I think there is perhaps, I would say, we have cited this. I think both is important for the psychoanalytic process to see it's a real relationship. There is this setting where two people in the room meet. They are real persons, but at the same time, a kind of dramatic play, fantasy creation coming up from fantasies of the patient, from our own reactions as analysts come into play and gradually just build up, let's say, the story that is mainly related to the patient's biography, the patient's relationships, and what's going on in her or his life at the moment, but now in relation with us.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Herbert Blass. Dr. Blass is currently the president of the International Psychoanalytic Association, and he's a training analyst for both adults, children, and adolescents, and a member of the German Psychoanalytic Association. Our conversation today has two parts. The first is our encounter with a real challenging clinical problem, that is, what happens when we're in an intense, intimate relationship with a patient, an analyst, and we discover that we feel their political leanings, at times passionate political leanings, are anathema to us. What happens then? Well, that's no small matter, and very few people have written about it, but Herbert has. He wrote a paper that was presented 2 years ago at the IPA meeting in Cartagena, and that is our first topic of conversation. The second topic is his vision for the field going forward, and by that I mean his vision along with Vice President Katie Bogliato. And their vision is what he calls having psychoanalytic presence. Now, this is an extension of what we have known in past administrations. It started out with IPA in the community, then it grew to IPA in the community in the world, and now with this administration, it's IPA also and its presence of psychoanalysis. And he has a particular interest in the psychoanalytic presence in universities. But I want to draw your attention to something, and this is something I commented on towards the end of the interview. When he talks about psychoanalytic presence, it's of course obvious on one level that he means that we have a presence in universities and communities, and we make our voices and our spirits and our humanity known to those who we are working with. But if you keep in mind his notion of presence as it applies to the first half of the interview, where he talks about patients who really tug at him with very difficult political provocations, and he's not rigid about his reaction to it. He's not endlessly flexible about it. He has a psychoanalytic presence is what it is. He's always thinking, what does this mean? What does this mean for him, the patient? And what does this mean for him, the analyst? And we are going to discuss some of those cases. And I can tell you that after I finish the interview with him, my sense is that our ship of the IPA is very well captained for the next number of years. He is not just interested in political issues. He has a number of other interests. He's a general psychiatrist. He is interested in psychosomatics. He has written about the image of the father, male identity and sexuality, and also aspects of thought function in the psychoanalytic process. His book, Time and the Experience of Time, has been published in German and will soon be out in English. I hope you find this a meaningful and reassuring introduction to our new president. And here's my conversation with Herbert Blass. Herbert, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you.
Hello.
We've been living in a world of political polarization for some time now. We've noted that friendships have often been disrupted. Even family members have felt alienated from each other. And then there's the psychoanalytic relationship. Analysts, like everyone, have their own personal points of view, political or otherwise, and often hold them passionately. The issue, indeed the challenge, has not really been addressed in the literature is how do we encounter these political passions in the psychoanalytic chamber? Do we consider them to be, like everything, manifest data, awaiting elaboration of their latent and transference elaborations and meanings and fantasies? And what of the counter-transference? Now, Herbert, you have written on this topic, and very few people have. You presented a paper 2 years ago at the IPA meeting in Cartagena entitled Polarization of Cultural Political Beliefs and Analysts' Mind Under Fire. And we're going to spend time on this important contribution. But I also want to mention, of course, that you are the currently installed IPA president. Congratulations. And I want to also take time to invite you to share your thinking about our organization going forward over the next few years. But to start us off, I'd like to read the opening paragraph from your paper, which really sets the background, the context for us to understand what happens when tensions often reach peak levels. You write, in contrast to Freud's skeptical view of countertransference as a disturbing phenomena, attention to the analyst's emotional reactions is now a natural part of our work. We want to read out the communicative processes that take place from our own emotional reactions in the analytic couple by means of introjection and projection. Nevertheless, only the relative disappearance of the analyst as a real person allows the joint creation of a dramatic play with the transference neurosis as unwitting fantasy creation. And it is part of the analyst's competence to not lose sight of the Janus face quality of the psychoanalytic situation as a simultaneity of actuality and fantasy creation. Again, as a simultaneity of actuality and fantasy creation. So that's the foundation of the encounter. But then you go on to note, but what happens when the cultural and political beliefs of both come into such serious conflict that a mutual line of fire threatens to establish itself? And indeed, you go on to say, the intensity of one's feelings and their disruptive potential can be compared to the danger of crossing boundaries within the polarized duality of libido and aggression when it comes to holding and handling intense erotic sexual impulses. Herbert? The floor is yours to elaborate this quite challenging clinical phenomena we're facing.
Yeah, Harvey, thank you very much for citing these remarks from my side. And I think that the comparison which I made here is related to the danger of transgressing boundaries from the side of the analyst. It's not totally the same, but it's because the emotions and the danger of being too much involved as an analyst, if you don't pay attention to what is happening in ourselves with our own emotions, then it can be similar. I think there is perhaps, I would say, we have cited this. I think both is important for the psychoanalytic process to see it's a real relationship. There is this setting where two people in the room meet. They are real persons, but at the same time, a kind of dramatic play, fantasy creation coming up from fantasies of the patient, from our own reactions as analysts come into play and gradually just build up, let's say, the story that is related, mainly related to the patient's biography, the patient's relationships, the patient's biography, and what's going on in her or his life at the moment, but now in relation with us as analysts. And this is usually more or less possible without too many threats to boundary transgressions when the emotional level is, let's say, is not too intense. I don't think that we don't need emotions. I think emotions are very necessary. But when the emotions are very heated, and this is something which Freud, for instance, compared with a fire in a theater, what's going on when there is a fire in the theater, and this is related to erotic transference, when also the analyst could be too much heated in her or his emotions, then it's important just to be careful and to especially to watch one's own emotions. And in a way, this is happening to my experience when we are turning to political questions, political situations in which we as analysts are also involved as citizens. And I think the difficulty here is that we are perhaps not so much able anymore to use what I would call trial identifications with the patient. We can work with our patients better when we are in a more moderate state and we have more the possibility to identify with them as a trial identification and to put ourselves in the shoes of the patient. This is, I think, to my mind, is necessary all the time, but it's much more difficult when we touch on beliefs or convictions or political statements in ourselves, when the view of the patient is totally opposite to ours. And this is then a difficulty. And this was my idea. How can we think about this? We can talk about this when we are facing this difficulty, because we have to keep our analytic abstinence, one could say, or neutrality. But at the same time, we are working with the emotions. And this was the theme for me, why I chose this title. Not only the title, but also to describe this with two patients.
Yeah, and we'll get to those two patients. Your paper does not take up the different kind of challenge we face when we find ourselves in fundamental agreement with the political views of our analysts and how that can disguise important material.
That's true.
We often, yeah. I think the temptation is just to sort of smile and go along and say, oh, see how wise the patient is. They see the world as I do. But that's for another paper.
This is also a danger. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, for sure. For sure, yeah. You do give a number of clinical examples, and the first two have to do with what you call COVID deniers, and also a patient who denies Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And what you write about, speaking of trial identifications, you say, it became very difficult for me to muster trial identifications for the patients because they had become opponents of my private convictions. That's a very rich and difficult notion to sit with. They had become opponents of my private convictions. That they can be either opponents or agreeers with our private convictions isn't usually something that we consider as we listen behind the couch. But reflecting the tense moments we are living in, our private convictions are very present. And that was the challenge that you wrote about, that they have become opponents of my private convictions. And you went on to say, and I want to ask you about this, with the person who you felt was a COVID denier, you wrote the following. You wrote, I had to reveal my assessment of reality, which was different from that of the lateral thinkers. Lateral thinkers, I've come to learn, are people who are essentially working outside of consensual reality, which was different from them. And at the same time, a certain combative atmosphere grew in the analytic field. Now, again, this is not an everyday experience for any of us, but it is an experience of many of us. Walk us through what this was like for you, both internally and in the room.
Yeah, I think my impression was that because these were very, very heated themes, that if I would have tried what I tried first, to listen to the patient and to try to understand what's going on in her or him, and at the same time listening to my own reactions, the patient was, I think, able also discover my reactions. I think it would have been a denial to say I can, let's say, hide myself or stay neutral in the way that the patient is not able to read me. I think patients also, in a way, are able to read and sense what's going on inside me. And sure, I think I found it much more important for the process between the patient and me, and also for the authenticity between the patient and me, just more to state that we can try, that I wanting to try to understand what's going on with the patient, but at the same time make it clear that we are also talking of different psychic, not political realities, I would say, not psychic realities, but just I found it a better basis for the patient, that the patient could a kind of confirmation to know where I am at this moment, because this gave a more clear possibility also just not to discuss. I didn't want to have a discussion about the political issues. This was very clear. I didn't want to have a political discussion in the room. But I found just a kind of revealing of the pure fact that I have another position as important for the possibility to go on.
That's a very key point. It makes a great deal of sense, but it leaves us all, as we face our own moments like that, with a real challenge, because none of us are pure in our thinking. And when we hear somebody exposing a political point of view that if it was outside of the room, would be very disturbing for us just on a manifest level. But inside the analytic room, it is and isn't disturbing. It is disturbing, but we have to be aware that it's disturbing. And we also then have to understand that we've been provoked, which gets us to your next patient in a moment. And whether we do reveal our version of reality or whether we don't is a very challenging question that probably has no right answer, but needs to be grappled with.
Perhaps I must say, I would say I didn't totally reveal my position at this, but it was clear that I had another position. I would call it in this way. I would not just say to the patient, listen, this is my position, listen to me, and you have to follow my position. This is what I don't want to emphasize. But it's more, in a way, it was clear for the patient and me that there are two different convictions or realities without describing my political conviction or position. Yes, in detail. I didn't do this.
Speaking of provocation, let me ask you to introduce John to our listeners, who you write about in more detail.
John came to me in his early 20s after he had dropped out of university, and he spent his time during the day mostly with computer pornography, while at the same time masturbating, also playing eagle shooter games, or was sleeping. So the whole his daily life was an oscillation between these activities, and he lived alone in a small flat and had hardly any contact to his divorced parents, and also almost no contact to peers. So he really lived alone. And when he first came to me, he triggered really a feeling of sadness and concern in me, because I had conjured him up the image of a lonely boy. This was, I felt very much. At the same time, the way he spoke to me, it was also clear, and I could feel that he was also not lonely, but also there was a lot of hatred in him. And hatred against himself, but also hatred against other people. This was, for me, very palpable. And so I felt prepared when he one day told me that he very often felt hatred and disgust towards people, including himself. And here, perhaps, this is the reason why I want to present John, and perhaps I can make the theme of just also the emotional presence of the analysts much more clear, because I have made several interpretations during the therapy with him, that his porn consumption was an attempt to gain power and control over, for him, dangerous and subjectively hated women in his fantasy. But at the same time, I had the feeling that all my interpretations didn't reach him enough. Yeah. So for him, perhaps they were a lot shallow. He came, but and I used also my emotions just to show him this connection between his hidden hatred, self-hatred, and his withdrawal from the world. But I had the feeling it's not deep enough what's going on between him and me on an emotional level. And this changed abruptly when he began to ascribe a positive historical value to Hitler. And he just said, about Hitler, even if it wasn't quite right about the Jews, but with this positive valuation of Hitler, he hit me really like a blow, and this horrified me from this young person. And this was something where he, in a way, I think one could say he could reach me, but in a way where I felt horrified. This changed the emotional atmosphere, and it made me also more alert, but it also led me just to try to understand his admiration for the triumphant rise of a social loser, Hitler, as another attempt of self-rescue. Und I said, oh, this is also something where you can find yourself also more strong when you see this man as someone who had conquered the world or tried to conquer the world. But when I at the same time spoke of the Shoah and the killing of so many Jewish citizens, then he discovered my, one could say, my weak spot. Yeah? So he could sense this is a point where he can hit me. And I couldn't, and I didn't want to hide this. The fact that I was someone who, as a German, is sad, horrified, and feel a deep feeling of guilt and shame about what the Germans have done. This was something which he could really discover and feel. And at the same time, when he has felt this, he started just to work on this and to come back again and attack me with this, yeah, by describing all these different stories. And then at the same time, this was at the first campaign of the American President Trump, then he became a fan of Trump. And then he also reported that he, during the night, when all other were sleeping in Germany, he followed and watched also the campaign and of Trump. And what I say, at the same time, I felt when he was always talking about this, that I, on one hand, wanted to understand what was going on. This was my analytic attitude towards him. And on the other hand, I had to simultaneously worry about controlling both my internal outrage and helplessness. So, and this is the reason why I said that his reality and my reality were diametrically opposed. Yeah. And this was the question, how could I deal with this? And I sensed in myself, when I now looked at my counter-transfer, this is the reason why I think this is important about the presence, what is going on in the consulting room. I more and more had impulses, I would say, to kick him out. Yeah. So I could not stand anymore in a way what he was doing with me. And the other hand was to treat him as if he was would be my own child, my own son. So this kind of splitted counter transference, could one say, but perhaps also a kind of personal transference from my side. This is very hard to differentiate. Came into the room, and when he sensed this, he intensified. I would call a kind of bombardment. He then brought a lot of videos from Iraq, from people who were beheaded and so. And this was really difficult for me to contain. And I think that then I was able to make a conceptualization what was going on to my mind. And he felt that I was also very tense in my emotions. But I had then the feeling that the capacity for him to horrify me, to outrage me, was an expression of effectiveness and power for himself. So I think if I would have been calm all the time, yeah, and if he wouldn't have sensed that I really was hit by his fantasies and his actions, I think he would have had the feeling that I'm not interested in him. So this is a kind of one could think is this a kind of perverse transference and so. But what I want to say, the stress, I think it was important that he could feel that there was something emotionally going on with me, and that I was struggling with this. And after some time, I made a corresponding interpretation. I said, the whole time you have made me feel how strong and effective you are, because you know how to trigger violent feelings in me. So this was my attempt, yeah, to describe what was going on between him and me. And this astonished him. But and he said, because he had thought that that I was indifferent to him, and that his descriptions would leave me, as he called it, cold. So this is it was important the fact that he could affect me with this was for him a kind of feeling of power, and but also of emotional engagement. And when I can go on, because then I think this was important, we could then do also another analytical work, because when it was clear that I was emotionally grasped and caught by him, then he described an earlier scene with his father, where some years ago he had told his father about his suicidal fantasies, whereupon the father, after this report, had angrily replied that he, the father, didn't want to be blackmailed by, as the father called it, such a shit. And the father had turned away. And now, after remembering this scene, it became clear that John wanted me to take him seriously with his shit, one could say. Yeah. So it's, and it was very clear that his aggressively presented unconscious desire was always,
in other words, you tolerated his provocation, unlike the father.
Right. Yeah. Yes. But I tolerated. But I was also really struggling with this.
The way you wrote it is that his potential for destruction before he brought up Hitler had not yet reached me deeply enough, and then he found a way to reach you deeply enough by finding your soft spot in idealizing Hitler. And when you and I had discussed this, we discovered that we are both appreciators of the work of Peter Blow Sr. He wrote a paper and a book entitled Son and Father, where he makes the case that certainly teenage boys, and often older men who nevertheless live as teenage boys, feel the need to, that their libido, that their attachment to their father figures, the only way they know how to identify it and express it is through hostile provocation, but that it's a compromise for many elements, one of which is their longings for love, hence the loneliness that you discovered. And it sounded like that you, in your feeling sympathetic about him when you first met him, that you were able to move that compromise formation along so that he could claim how important you were to him and his ability to attach to you. Does that sound fair?
Yes, this is exactly what I feel and think, and also it corresponds to my conception about this, and which I wanted to show and describe with this young patient.
I want to ask you about the last sentence that you wrote in this case, and then we're going to turn to your presidency. You wrote about John, you say, "My personal political conviction was part of my required countertransference." That's that's not a throwaway line. That's an important concept. Can you tell us what you've come to understand about required countertransference?
Yeah, I mean by this that this young man was really looking and searching for an answer, for an emotional answer. And this emotional answer, I think, was only possible by the way that I reacted emotionally intensely, and in would not, but at the same time would not turn away. Yeah. So this is, I think, what the father did. I don't want to compete with the father here, but I think this was the reaction of the father. But I think what I want to say, I have the impression that this can happen in these polarized positions, that there is a need for countertransference, that we as analysts have to be emotionally caught by our patients, and that we also sense and also convey to them that they are able to reach us. At the same time, of course, to find ways just to interpret this and to connect again and see this, as you said, and this is also what I really appreciate with Peter Blow Sr., to see that also, perhaps also in adolescence, the most attacked person is also the most loved person. Yeah. So in a way, to see that behind these intense aggressive aggressive transference, and then the also first aggressive countertransference, it's important to sense this and then to work it through in our internal work with ourselves, and then to find ways just to give it back in a, one could say, also digested way.
You know, it's really a fortunate segue, because being able to tolerate multiple transferences, both of an affectionate and hostile sort, is certainly in the job description of the IPA presidency. So with that, let me invite you to share your vision for our field and let us know what you would like the IPA to grow into over the course of the next few years.
Yeah, I chose as a theme for my term of office the presence. I think psychoanalysis should be present. Present where? Where present? I think present in more in the world, more in our, but also more in, I would say, about a binocular view. I think I want to have the psychoanalysis more present again in science, in universities, also in social connections and the social field, so that psychoanalysis is seen with all its potential for understanding human relations, for understanding human internal conflicts, also for difficult relationships, and also for just the understanding of cultural phenomena that we are now facing in different parts of the world. A lot of destruction, a lot of aggression, and this is something which is a theme of psychoanalysis where we can contribute a lot. Also, I think to the fate of children, how children live in our world. We have a lot of children who live in very difficult relationships and circumstances, and we in the IPA, we have several options also to offer understanding and help for this, what we call a worldwide youth crisis. And also, I think, of course, you see all the conflicts. I don't want to be omnipotent. I think the IPA cannot solve the world problems, but we can offer our analytic understanding and how we can try to solve and aggressive problems, and how we can offer understanding for mutual respect and mutual understanding, which can help to change, especially aggressive conflicts. This is something which, and the other hand, I think it's also important that now in, I will go more to the scientific life, that in universities, the bashing of psychoanalysis as a method that is, as is often said, not scientifically enough, and can just be corrected. I think we have now several studies, also research studies, where we can show effectively that psychoanalysis really is able to reduce symptoms, for instance, to reduce depression, to reduce anxiety disorders. And this has to be more known, and this should be shown to the university. And for instance, I have now also recreated a committee on psychoanalysis and university, which has started its work now, and where several university teachers and professors from all three, four regions of the IPA, also from Europe, from North America, Latin America, and Asia Pacific, come together, and they are just developing a plan how the research results of psychoanalysis can be better conveyed to other parts of university. This is something, perhaps in short, what I would call presence in the outer world or to the social world. But also, I think it's important that the IPA is more present inside its members or among its members, because sadly enough, several members are members of the IPA, but they often don't know what they get, and they say they don't know what they get from the IPA. And this is really a pity, because the IPA has to offer a lot. And there are so many committees, for instance, and so many webinars on different levels of the psychoanalysis, that even if it's clinical psychoanalysis or if it is applied psychoanalysis in also social affairs or in group relations. And so there's a lot of stuff that we have to offer to our members. And this should be seen more by the members than it has been seen by many until now. I want to combine these under the heading of presence.
Mm-hmm. It's a continuation, it sounds to me, of a vision both from Virginia Unger two presidencies ago and Harriet Wolf, and now you, from the IPA in the community to IPA in the community in the world, and now presence. It seems like a natural evolution of taking these ideas and growing them and sharing them widely.
I feel very much in line, I want to say, I feel very much aligned with the previous administrations, with Virginia Unger and Sergio Nick, and also with Harriet Wolf and Adriana Prengler. And I think that our term now, together with Katie Bogliato and Adela Escardo, we are continuing what has been already started in the past. And I'm very grateful to all of the colleagues that I have mentioned, that they have just really worked a lot. And I think they have already developed several excellent, important projects, and I really am eager to work on them and to continue them. But what I want to add also is more to include, this is important to me, also the question of technology. What is going on in our modern world with all the chances but also dangers of more and more artificial intelligence, of what's going on also with technological possibilities to with assisted reproductive medicine, and to see what does it mean for the psychic life of people. So the question, is it something which is enriching for the psychic life of people to have more medical chances, for instance, to become pregnant than or to have a baby than in previous years? But is it also, on the other hand, something which could increase a feeling of omnipotence and a kind of narcissistic omnipotence, which could also have some negative aspects to the psychic development of children and of adults as well? So the question, what does it mean? What are the implications of our more and more technically influenced life? This is also something which I think is one of the main themes for us in the future. Already now, but also in the future.
If we take your idea of presence and we listen to our conversation today, it runs through our whole conversation, because as I hear it, we were describing patients who present with manifest political commitments, passions, if you will, and you struggle through your honest experience of them to find both within you the psychoanalytic presence, the psychoanalytic voice, and then to try to help them discover something beyond their manifest commitment/provocations, to be able to listen themselves through your psychoanalytic presence that you've shared with them. And likewise, in the outer community, whether it be the university, the political arena, the social arena, the research arena, it's the same notion of let's find this psychoanalytic presence, because like in the clinical situation, it can offer so much. Like in the social environmental situation, it can offer so much. So your psychoanalytic presence is your gift and your mission for the IPA, and I am moved by it. I see how it can be so enriching in the clinical situation, and I'm excited to see how it enriches our wider world. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, thank you.
Herbert, it's a pleasure, and I do want to acknowledge as well, you're writing this paper is unique, and hopefully we will hear more from colleagues who struggle with this, because it is a ubiquitous phenomena in the office, and your courage and clarity, I really want to respect and honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Harvey. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.